It's All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. As we do each Friday at 10 minutes of 5, a discussion about the week in North Carolina politics. Back as usual are Rob Schofield, director of the Progressive NC Policy Watch, and Mitch Kokai, senior policy analyst at the conservative John Locke Foundation. Hi, fellas.
Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
On Wednesday, a much-criticized legislative committee, which had been studying the pros and cons of breaking up large public school districts, adjourned and did not make any policy recommendations. Critics have said for months that they're worried this panel would lead to a resegregation of public schools. This issue was raised in part because parents and teachers were concerned that big districts were not meeting the needs of students. Rob, the issue is tabled for now. Where would you like to see it go next?
I'd like to see it go away. I think that obviously people have legitimate concerns about the public education that's being delivered to their children in many districts, both small and large across the state. But the idea of moving backwards, of going, trying to move backwards to a time in which we break up our school districts, where we, in effect, resegregate them, is fraught with huge problems. There are constitutional issues. There are increased costs that will be imposed on school districts in terms of replicating the same services in multiple districts. This is sort of the model, actually, that we see in states like New Jersey, where they have hundreds of school districts with just a handful of schools in them, and it's very inefficient. I understand where some of the people are coming from in terms of their frustration sometimes with what our public schools deliver. I would argue that that's mostly a matter of inadequate funding, but clearly, we don't need to go back to this back-to-the-future model, go back to the 50s and 60s and have, you know, segregated school districts. We see in Halifax County, one of the few areas that still have these divided school districts, that that's not working out well at all. We need to stick with our unified county school districts.
What impressed me most about this group was the way it went about its business, because when it first started, no one really knew what was the goal. I mean, I think a lot of people thought, oh, this legislature is going to want to split up the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system or the Wake County school system or other large systems because they are so large. And you heard a lot of concern about the possibility of resegregating the schools. Well, from the very first meeting, Bill Brawley, the Mecklenburg County representative who chaired the group, said, look, this committee is not going to come up with a specific recommendation to split any school districts. We're going to look at what you would have to address if you were wanting to split up a school district or even wanting to think about it. And then the committee progressed to deal with all of those issues. Didn't really stack the deck with people who were saying we need to split up districts. When they got the presentations from academics about what the research showed, they didn't stack the deck there. The academics said, hey, much of the research here is outdated, and what research we do have sends mixed messages about this. And then at the end, the committee said, we don't have a recommendation. And if someone wants to continue looking into this, there needs to be a heck of a lot more study. I think this is the type of study that the legislature would be well advised to do more of. If some big issue comes out and you think that, well, hey, maybe the answer is to split up a school district. Set up a committee like this, get people from all sides the chance to talk about it, and then at the end, if it doesn't sound like as good as an idea as it did maybe at the beginning, you say, we're not going to do it.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think that's a pattern we haven't seen much in the General Assembly in recent years, where we've sort of had lots of dramatic changes to state law sprung on us at the last minute and passed with minimal debate. So, yes, I echo that. Good on them for having a thorough discussion.
Is this perhaps an example of these binary times that we're in? Rhetoric gets cranked up and, oh, they're going to do this. I don't want to say there was necessarily a rush, but pretty quickly there was this this note about, oh, they're going to resegregate the schools. Is it possible that there wasn't some sinister, evil, ulterior motive here?
Well, I mean, resegregation of the schools is something that's already happening. It's been happening for years in North Carolina. And there's also been a lot of demand in some corners, mostly conservative, for breaking school districts up. We've heard this in Wake County. So I don't know that it was necessarily sinister, but I don't think it would have been a good idea. And I think it was real. I think there are many people who were serious about pushing in that direction. And it's really important and good that so much strong information, such a strong pushback has been forthcoming, both from officials and from advocates and from just plain old community members.
The most recent sorry, you want to jump in here?
I was just going to say, I think there was some politics involved here. The people who feared that the General Assembly was going to take steps that they didn't like really jumped the gun to some extent. And, you know, at the very beginning, when the school committee was set up and there wasn't a whole lot of detail about why. It makes sense if you fear the General Assembly and what it might do to raise the red flag and say, hey, look, this committee's going to start its work. We need to watch out for it because it may come up with some ideas we don't like. But fairly early on, the people who worked with the committee set a different agenda than what the opponents had suggested. And I think from that point on, the talk about resegregation was a little bit overblown. And it makes those who continued to toe that line all the way through the work of this group, made them seem like the people who cry wolf.
The most recent revenue projections forecast a state surplus of $265 million. According to the State Budget Office, that number is likely high, as an unusual number of people paid their taxes early. So for conversation's sake, let's call it $200 million. And for context, that is roughly one-half of 1% of the state budget. When legislators do reconvene next month for the short session, what are the top two things that you would like to see them do with that money? Mitch.
I think both of my top two are about the same thing, and that is don't spend it all in one place or don't overspend in an area where you think you have this revenue surplus, so let's go ahead and jack up the spending some more. What they ought to do is say, look, our projections actually came out about where we expected. Let's keep on the same path we are. I think you are going to see some proposals, and I think the General Assembly is going to be inclined to go along with a proposal that's going to come from Governor Cooper to deal with some issues like school safety, like the treatment of Gen X. But I wouldn't go overboard if I were a member of the legislature and say, we've got a lot more money to play with. Let's go ahead and spend it. Basically, their projections are about right. I mean, you said it. They're within 0.5% or so of what they expect for a budget that large. So to use this surplus as an excuse to go on a spending spree would be a bad idea. There will be some items that need more spending, but they should temper their enthusiasm for increased spending by looking at where the actual total figures are.
But of that 200, half of it to savings, a chunk of it to Gen X, and where would you like? I mean, it's still $200 million, even though it is a relatively small percentage.
One of the nice things is that the General Assembly almost unanimously passed a law within the last couple of years that will force a chunk of the revenue surplus to have to go into savings, 15%. They could put a little bit more of that into savings, or they could take what they have left over, put into something like the Gen X funding, something like dealing with school safety measures. Those seem to be sort of the big topics that are up for debate right now. And also perhaps prison, helping with the prisons.
Yeah, I would put the word surplus in air quotes because it's not a meaningful surplus. North Carolina's public structures and services have been hemorrhaging for years. We've had huge cuts in teachers, school supplies, instructional support for teachers, teacher assistants, transportation, Lowell schools. The list goes on and on and on in education alone. And then you've got the environment. And then you've got the prisons. And then you've got the court system that's starving for resources. It reminds me, I was trying to think of an analogy. It's like a suburbanite with 2 acres of drought-stricken lawn, and someone comes up with a barrel of water and says, where would you like to put it? What problem would you like to solve? We've got a drought everywhere in our public structures and services because when you adjust for inflation, we've been slashing public investments for years. And so it's just a drop in the bucket and not nearly what we need. And in fact, we're confronting the reality that we're going to have more tax cuts taking effect in the years ahead. We're going to have further reductions in investment in essential services and structures. So this is, you know, it's better than an even bigger deficit. But I would argue that we still confront an enormous deficit when it comes to funding government.
And I think politically, the interesting thing that we're going to see play out in the spring is just how much of a fight is there going to be between Governor Cooper and the Republican-led General Assembly over a budget. The governor will likely put forward some proposals that would increase spending on some of the things that we've mentioned. And I would not be surprised if it also calls for the General Assembly to not go ahead with the tax cuts that are scheduled to take effect in 2019. My guess is legislative leaders will see that proposal, file it in the circular file, and then they'll have another budget fight, probably a veto and a chance to override.
A battle between Cooper and the legislature?
Shock.
I can't imagine that.
We're now less than a month from the primary. This week, the Charlotte Black Caucus released its endorsements, and two incumbents from Mecklenburg County, both African-American Democrats, did not receive support. Senator Joel Ford and House Rep. Rodney Moore both do have challengers as well. What does this development tell us about the divides within the party and or moderate urban lawmakers, Rob?
I think there's a new and promising generation of progressive African-American leaders coming along, and the advocacy groups are looking for inspiring progressive leaders. This is a, you know, this is the moment of resistance for the progressive movement in the United States and in North Carolina, and they're not looking for politicians who are looking to cut deals with the powers that be. They're looking for politicians to lead us in a different direction. And I think that both Ford and Moore has some ethical challenges that have been raised, and Ford has clearly made himself a conservative on lots of issues. I think they just don't resonate with the voters in that area. It's not surprising to me that that an advocacy group like that would endorse alternative progressive candidates.
My sense is that there's a little bit of difference in the two cases. In the case of Rodney Moore, my guess is this has probably more to do with the issues he's facing with campaign finances than anything else. But the issue with Joel Ford is, I think, a sense that Democrats are saying, hey, you're too likely to deal with Republicans. You're going to vote with them on the budget. If you're not going to be with us on major key issues, then we're not going to be with you when it comes primary time.
All right, up to the district. This was unofficially Zuck Week. Hours of congressional testimony from Mark Zuckerberg, plenty of it offering the excitement of an IT staff meeting, has led to much debate, critique, and conversation across the country. Plenty of skeptics are wondering if any real oversight or changes will come of all this as it pertains to Facebook and social media. Reason for optimism, yes or no, and why?
I don't know that I would look at this and then hold my breath that anything major is going to happen. We see this many times with Congress, that they'll haul in people who are involved in something that has led to some sort of controversy or some major outcry. The members of Congress wag their fingers at whoever's in front of them and say, do something different or we're going to regulate you, and then nothing eventually happens. Now, this could be different this time. I think so many people use Facebook and so many people have had concerns about their information and how it's being used without their knowledge or consent that something might happen. But based on the hearings that we saw this week, I wouldn't say that there's a likelihood that anything major is going to change.
Yeah, these congressional hearings are often described by folks as sort of a kabuki theater. It's almost like they come and play their roles, and as long as the object of the committee hearing is, you know, properly deferential to the committee members and expresses regret and concern, and you know, and that will basically assuage the legislators. And I fear that maybe that's the case here, because I really do think we need some significant reform. I for one, am very troubled, as I think a lot of people are, about the interference in our elections, the connections between Russian interference and pirating of Facebook information, and what it means for the future. So I think we desperately need more investigation into this. It goes beyond Mark Zuckerberg. It goes to some politicians who've had connections to it. I want that information to come out. But this hearing itself is, you know, at best, one small part of that.
House Speaker Paul Ryan announced on Wednesday, after 20 years in Congress, he will be calling it quits later this year. His decision not to run for re-election sets off a cluttered race for the next speakership. Among the possible successors are North Carolina Congressman Patrick McHenry, the fourth-ranking Republican in that chamber, as well as, I'll call him antagonist, Mark Meadows, co-founder and leader of the hardline Freedom Caucus. Though we should note that Meadows has said he does not have interest in the speakership as of the moment. For now, who, in your opinion, is more likely to be the next speaker?
Well, first of all, the Republicans would have to maintain control of the House for this to even be a debate. I mean, it's entirely possible that Democrats will win control of the U.S. House, and so Meadows, McHenry, and others would be battling it out to see who would be the minority leader. If the Republicans maintain control and those two are in the mix, my guess is that the majority of the Republican caucus would be more inclined to go along with McHenry just because he's been part of the power structure and was a supporter of previous speakers, going back to the Boehner years and before that, being one of the people who supported Tom DeLay. I mean, he's been a part of that process for a long time. Mark Meadows, as head of the Freedom Caucus, has been one of the groups that has bucked Republican Party leadership. So my guess is that McHenry would be more likely. I don't think that either one of them is likely to be the next Speaker of the House, though.
Who? Well, I would just note two things. One, a majority of the Republican caucus may not be enough to land somebody a speakership, right? I mean, you need a majority of the body,
right?
As I understand it. Who is the next speaker?
Ooh, good question. At this point, knowing what we know about the elections, I would say middle of the road Democrat. Who, if the Democrats take over?
I'm sorry. Where are those?
That would be a choice, or from the Republican side, the name you hear sometimes is Steny Hoyer. Not Steny Hoyer. He would be the
Democrat.
He'd be the Democrat.
Yeah,
perhaps.
Right.
On the Republican side, someone other than McHenry, who's been in the leadership.
Okay.
Kevin McCarthy's a name you hear floating about. That's a possibility.
Right.
My guess is right now that both parties are so focused on who's going to win that the leadership fight's going to have to wait.
I think I just heard you say there's plenty of them in response to moderate Democrats.
From my perspective,
okay.
Sure. I mean, I would think someone like Steny Hoyer is an example of someone who's been an establishment Democrat for a long time. And, I mean, certainly not someone out on the left of the party.
Sure, sure.
And so, yeah, I think there is a chance that the Democrats could take back over. But I think we should get back to the issue here. What this is really about, it seems to me, of Ryan going away and what would seem to be the prime of his career, it's Donald Trump. Donald Trump continues to sort of so poison the environment in Washington that an enormously powerful young man in the prime, relatively young man in the prime of his political career, is walking away because it's become such a dreadful job. And I'm not sure that there aren't a lot of politicians. Mark Meadows might be an example of someone who probably wouldn't even want to be speaker. He'd probably rather be on the outside lobbing bombs at the process rather than trying to keep a diminished Republican majority, let's say, somehow in line in the world of a Donald Trump, second part of a Donald Trump presidency. It's going to be a killer job for whoever gets it.
My guess is that Trump does play some sort of role. What we have to remember as well that Paul Ryan never really wanted to be the Speaker of the House.
That's
when
correct.
That opportunity came up, he basically said, I'm only going to do this if every faction—
Well, he said no initially,
right,
and then they had to go
right.
back to him.
Yeah, and he said, I'm only going to do this if every faction within the party says
that I'm
going to be the Speaker and that you're going to work with me. And he found, I think after he'd been in the Speaker's job for a while, that it was just what he expected it was going to be, trying to herd cats who are going in very different directions. And then during the past couple of years, the House has passed a number of major pieces of legislation that have then gone to die in the Senate. Some might see that as a good thing or a bad thing, but from Ryan's perspective, that has to just add to the frustration that he's seen as Speaker, and I think the job has played out exactly as he thought it would when he reluctantly took it.
Mitch Kokai is with the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield writes for NC Policy Watch. Thank you both.
Thanks, man.
Thank you.
To hear an extended version of this conversation, visit our website, WUNC.org. You will not hear me next week. I'm going out on paternity leave, but the segment will continue. Rusty Jacobs will have This Week in North Carolina Politics beginning next Friday.